Thank you.
So a new word maybe for some people is usufruct. Another fun vocab. We're having the lexicon of sustainability here as adjoining tenants in this space. And they're interested in the nomenclature to describe the things that are happening that are positive and can endure. And another fun word is cadastre. Cadastre is a land inventory. It's a French word. Anyway, you can put it in your lexicon. C-A-D-A-S-T-R-E. Okay, so now I'm very pleased to introduce Gary Nabhan, who I think is going to reflect on what does it mean, all these highly motivated people getting their knees dirty at the very bottom of our economy. What does it mean, such ambition and such reformist passion inserting itself at the bottom of our food economy? What is this like inflammation of the young people? And what's the historic precedent? What does it mean? So he's coming representing the pollinators. Gary's a very famous ethnobotanist and biologist, writing like 15 or more books. And he's also representing slow money. So between the butterflies and the green money, we have Gary.
Greetings, Earthlings. I have to put out my sign first. Farmers as the foundation of civilization, but one thing I'd like to say with that is I've never really liked that word, civilization. And if I were to redo Webster's sign, I think I would say community or civil society, that we've marginalized some people who we've declared aren't as civilized as us, and at the same time, some of the people in our nation who claim to be civilized have allowed some of the greatest grievances. So how do we readdress a phrase like that so that the emphasis is back on community? Because a lot of what we're talking about is not going to be done just by individual genius or one person or one family's hard work, but by a community of support, as Elizabeth was saying. And how do we re-engage an entire community in what I believe several people have called the restoration economy, not just for food security, but also for poverty alleviation in our communities? So I'm going to do a funny little dance here. This is sort of a talk in three parts. As Severin said, I'm in part representing the board of Slow Money that, with Woody's blessing and the rest of the board members, really want to be in service to whatever comes out of this meeting. Slow Money is but one of the many vehicles. Food Link is doing a great job. The Bali Coalition is doing a great job of helping us rethink the ways that we can fund this work. And we're going to have a little funding scenario exercise near the end of my talk. So be thinking about your personal role in helping roll this out, and we'll get back to that in a little bit. As some of you know, since 2010, Slow Money itself has helped raise about $30 million that has gone in less than 4 years into over 220-some food and farming micro-enterprises. And that's just one part of the portfolio that we should be all talking about, of the ways that we help deal with this enormous land transfer of $400 million. But the other part that I want to bring up is that pardon?
It's $1 trillion, 400 million acres.
400 million acres, excuse me. I'm having number dyslexia since my concussion. So correct any other number that I screw up, either with a decimal point in the wrong place or not. But we're not just talking about the intergenerational transfer of land, but also that of agricultural knowledge and values, okay? That's also what's at stake here in this dialogue between greenhorns and greyhorns, or what was your word? Geezers, you know. Leave it to geezers, you know. So the point is that from a personal perspective, my grandfather was a Lebanese sheep herder and fruit grower on the Lebanon-Syria border, left Lebanon 100 years ago to keep from being entrained into the army, conscripted into the Turkish army. So it's a 100th year anniversary of a lot of Lebanese farmers coming to the U.S. And if I had had the capacity to have direct contact with him and get some of his traditional knowledge, I probably wouldn't have made so many god-awful mistakes raising sheep and certain kinds of fruits myself. That intergenerational knowledge is as rare and as endangered as this capacity for access of the land. And there are certain kinds of values that I don't want to say you have to grow up with, but they're much harder absorbing if you jump into the dance at middle age or whatever. So there's really three things there: the land transfer, the knowledge, and the values that we have to weave into this entire equation. So I'll talk for a moment about historic precedents, but we also have to consider the fact that climate change is bringing us into that new normal where some kinds of decisions that we will be making is about an unprecedented range among the mean of variation, that the amount of drought and perhaps the amount of flooding that we're going to get, as Boulder, Colorado experienced this last year, droughts and fires for 2 years, and then horrendous floods, 18 inches of rain in 36 hours, wiping out in a matter of just a few hours $50 million of irrigation structure. Well, it wasn't 36 hours of damage. It was really multiple years of degradation of the watersheds above that affected people. But the point is that some of the traditions that we want to build on, and that domain of knowledge that isn't in textbooks or in scientific papers that farmers have, we also need to pass on to young farmers who then have to take it in new directions as they adapt to unprecedented climatic, ecological, and economic conditions. For instance, this last year was the greatest amount of crop insurance money ever asked for by farmers, because so many have been damaged. Over 2,300 counties declared drought disaster areas, 4.5 times the previous record for the number of counties declared drought disasters. And so finally, my plea is to all the white hairs and gray hairs and blue hairs in this room, how do we step into the dance in helping greenhorns, but how do we also get out of the way in a way that the next time we have a meeting like this, all the speakers will be under 30? So let's talk about that. So again, one of my complaints about this sign is that I would really like to say food producers are the foundation of civil society, and that many of the same pressures and risks and stresses being faced by farmers are also being faced by fisherwomen and men, farm workers, foragers, and community foresters that are sharing the commons of natural resources and trying to bring its food into our communities. And that many of them are both sinking from the effects of climate change right now and the effects of the extractive economy. So when we talk about explaining what we've felt and learned and believed in about this meeting, I think we need to define agrarianism not as something that's just farmers, but all those other food producers, and in fact, all of those who care about justice in the food supply chain, as Elizabeth just spoke about. Agrarianism used to have wars, and including battles in the streets with certain kinds of urban movements. Look at the history of the Canadian agrarian movement and why it failed after once looking like it was going to run Canada, is because they set themselves at odds with factory workers in unions in the cities. Today's agrarianism is clearly farm folk, city folk working together. And that is significant because every other agrarian movement in North America has failed by either marginalizing the needs and values of people that are in cities, or the cities marginalizing the people in our rural communities. So this time, let's get it right, having an agrarianism that's so inclusive that city folk and rural folk are on the same side of history. The other thing I'd like to say is that we need whole food solutions, that we can't have heritage grain farmers if we don't have millers, if we don't have bakers and microbrewers in ways where we're not price fixing among those different parts of the food supply chain, but they're cross-referencing each other in a way where everyone can have livable wages. And we need to find a really diversified portfolio of financial and technical support to help everyone in that food supply chain. We've done this with a project in southern Arizona that's now up to over 3,000 acres of the oldest grain, cereal grain in the United States, white Sonora wheat, aside from corn and amaranth. And it's by constant feedback loops between millers, bakers, microbrewers, farmers, harvesters, to make it so that no one in these trial run, trial balloon recoveries of diversity in our food system is disadvantaged by the growing pains of leading it out over time. And so I just want to say that I get panicky sometimes where I find a young farmer who says, I think I'm going to make it. I just need to finish my Kickstarter campaign. And I think what one of the most important things that Greyhorns can help Greenhorns with is matching the financial strategy that they're trying for the particular stage that they're in their efforts alone or in a collaborative, with their current financial capabilities and what they project out as their needs over several years, so that we're looking at crowdfunding, slow food angel investors, community-supported agriculture, land trusts and conservation easements, and a whole variety of strategies in relation to the maturity of the farm operation or the orchard or the greenhouse or whatever, rather than thinking that any single one of these is going to be a silver bullet solution to bringing more farmers into land, that we really have to tightly match people's financial capabilities with the mechanism that best fits them at that point in their life and at that point in their operation. Finally, again, I just want to say, like the real estate agents say, location, location, location. With making the land transfer happen, it's community, community, community. You can't, as I've learned in 20 years of doing pollinator work, what one farm does alone to bring back pollinators is not enough to save pollinators. They don't know where the fence boundary is. They can go across it and get sprayed. They can go across it in devastated landscapes, and we have 100 million acres of land farmscapes devastated, where their pollinators have been decimated over the last 13 years by neonicotinoids and glyphosate. So of that 400 million acres, I got a number right. That's amazing. A fourth of that that young farmers will be inheriting is already devastated of some of the nature services that they will need. So inevitably, as Wes said this last night, every farmer in the future is going to have to be an ecological restoration expert rather than just an agronomist. Ecological restoration in a restoration economy setting is the only game that we will be playing, because we're making up for the wounds on the land that Aldo Leopold first pointed out to us. So if this is the largest land transfer that will take place since the United States government took over the management of this continent, we need to listen up to what that means. And that means that there will be winners and losers. And we need to frame our alliances so that capable young people who want to farm responsible are among the winners. But the winners also include the land itself and the people who've most been marginalized by how our food system has worked up until now. And they may not want to be farmers because they've been the stoop labor in cotton fields or tomato picking, but they are probably somewhere in the food system, and the solutions have to work for them as well. And so we need to frame our interest in food justice and sustainability in terms of a win-win kind of situation. That means that we use both the science, art, and ethics of farming to get it right across that whole food supply chain, rather than thinking it's about the Marlboro man riding into the sunset on the private land that he owns, or the celebrity chef on the Food Channel. I still don't know what the hell the Food Channel is, because every time I see that come up, I just click again if I'm someplace. But the point is, it has to work for all our allies that bring us our daily bread, from the pollinators to the soil microbes to the farmers to the millers, if it's going to work at all. So I want to go into a brief digression. We've had different lenses, thanks to Wes last night and Eric and especially Elizabeth with the last half century of how what we're doing today relates to social justice, about the historical roots of what we're doing in this room today. And I'm going to take this back to a completely different era and show that what we're here about today is completely embedded in the very roots of the Judeo-Christian Islamic traditions at its very core. So I'm going to tell this as a parable, because a bunch of those guys who we've read about in the Bible really believed in story, that story can help guide us, that it's more memorable than technical papers or even TV shows. So let's go back to story, and you can close your eyes for the next 2 or 3 minutes if you want to imagine this. So imagine a time when farmers and fishers of all cultures and creeds felt that the resources they required to make a living were declining, propelling them into financial peril, emotional despair, and financial disempowerment. Many of their neighbors who had once farmed or fished had given up and had left their villages to take menial jobs in the cities, serving the needs of the elite. In fact, as cities were burgeoning, developers and politicians took some of the best arable lands from farmers or established fancy resorts where fishing processing had formerly occurred around the best natural harbors. The growing urban markets demanded so much food that the soils and water began to be depleted of the very abundance that their forefathers had gradually nurtured over centuries of tireless, careful stewardship. This alarmed the best of the farmers and fishers, while others simply shoved the money gained from overexploitation into their pockets, for they could not, they could only see from one day to the next. The new urban elite did not emerge from local families, but from power alliance with absentee landowners who placed their intermediaries in key political and economic positions within their communities. They heavily taxed and regulated locals for any farmland or for fishermen for the harbors that they had used. They taxed them again for the food they produced and regulated them more there to get fees from them. And they taxed them once more for any of their harvest that was moved along the transportation arteries that the urban elite also controlled. When farmers and fishers suffered poor harvests, the banks loaned them money at high interest rate to get them through the next year, further increasing their debts. When the debt levels became too high, the bankers assumed the equity from their farmlands or from their fishing boats and harbors, and the farmers and fishers became sharecroppers or contract workers, but they were treated more and more like indentured servants. Many of the men, in particular, fell into despair, having lost control of the so-called property that had nourished their clan for many generations. Some of these men grew sullen, drinking more wine or taking more drugs that kept them in a stupor while their physical and emotional pain seemed to be dulled, at least for the moment. When family members expressed their worry that the men had become immobilized and despondent, the men lashed out at them, abusing their wives or children. Upon realizing what they had done, some of the men were overcome with grief and guilt, and they committed suicide. Others became revolutionaries and fought back, but many of them were thrown into prison or, in fact, crucified. That moment of agrarian crisis of which I'm speaking about occurred roughly 2,000 years ago around the Sea of Galilee in a region and in the region of Nazareth during the life of a man named Yeshua ben Yosef, that some of you know as Jesus of Nazareth, who allied himself with poor farmers and fishers. At that time, the seas and lands around the Sea of Galilee and Palestine were occupied by Roman troops. Within the life of Jesus, a town of 20,000 people grew up within a few miles of the Sea of Galilee, and that area had essentially become a police state and an extractive economy, sending the food that could have fed the local poor back all the way to Rome. But that moment of agrarian crisis, which I'm speaking about, is almost occurring today under identical conditions in hundreds of rural counties across the North American continent and in dozens of countries around the world. The rates of suicide among American farmers have never been higher, twice the national average for adults. Newsweek, if you saw it 2 weeks ago on the cover, Death of a Farm, said this. By the 1980s, farmers had started defaulting on their loans, and by 85, 250 farms closed every hour. The economic undertow sucked down farms and the people who had put their lives into them. Male farmers became four times more likely to kill themselves than male non-farmers, reports showed. And Leonard Freeborn said, in the West, the guys were jumping off silos. Since that crisis, the suicide rate for male farmers has remained steadily high. So to go into this with a romantic notion that this is going to cure us of some of our current problems without realizing the risks that we're asking some of you to take on our behalf would be ludicrous. There's real risks and real stresses and real consequences of becoming a young farmer at this time. And a year ago, four of us started an edible Baja Arizona magazine that now goes out to 500,000 readers in southern Arizona and Sonora, Mexico every 2 months. And Debbie Weingarten, who's affiliated with the National Young Farmers Coalition, has talked about these very stresses even among the most idealistic, organic, sustainable young farmers that we have in the Southwest. Remember that name, Debbie Weingarten and look up that article. We are still not removed from putting our youngest and best farmers at risk. To get out of the dreadful predicament that afflicts at least a third of the world's population, that small farmers, farmers, fishers, food service workers are currently working among, that those people themselves are most likely to suffer from poverty, hunger, and food security, that in the Southwest, the most frequent person coming to a food bank or a soup kitchen is a farm worker or a food service worker. We must circle back to once again form a covenant with the land and with one another, all of us in this room and all of the people that we care about, for today and into the future, for it will have more importance to our collective future on this dry, stony, water-scarce earth than ever before. So in addition to the principles, I suggest that Agrarian Trust and the National Young Farmers Coalition really work on such a covenant, and here's some elements of it that I think can be rewritten and made something that's co-written by hundreds of people. But let's look at some of these for a start. With future generations in mind, may my family and friends never leave the land we steward poorer, know its water scarcer than the conditions were before we acquired responsibility for their care. And that care can be by contract or by temporary ownership. May we keep the land meant to be farmed from being developed and re-envelop it with people dedicated to keep its inherent productivity intact into perpetuity. May we work as greenhorns to offer dignity, reciprocity, and respect to greyhorns willing to offer their land to us and to never betray our covenant with them and the land itself. May we seek to enrich the soil, diversify its plant cover, and deepen its roots both within and beyond the harvested fields, its grazed pastures or orchards. May we be diligent in learning how our practices affect those who live above and below us in our watershed and food shed, not only the human lives, but the other than human lives as well. May we participate in a regional culture of this land, and whenever possible, engage in community rites and calendric rhythms that bind us to our place. May we work to link consumers of the food, fiber, and timber we produce to the land on which it is produced, so that their values and ours are developed in harmony rather than in competition or in conflict. May we encourage our members, friends, and neighboring consumers to vote for what is best for the land at the polling booth and at the table. May we share with our neighbors not only our successes in stewardship, but cautionary words of wisdom gained from our past failures as well. And that's one of the things I loved about Elizabeth's talk, that sort of gorgeous memoir we just had from her, that she said what hasn't worked as much as what did work for her and her friends at different points in their lives. And may we refrain from solely focusing on increasing the saleable products from the land, but also focus on investing in the underlying natural processes which generate those products, experimenting with ways to control pests, diseases, and weeds in manners that does least harm to pollinators like bees and monarchs, or soil microbes, or pests and predators. May we make long-term decisions about the destiny of the land and the choice of its future caretakers by asking a simple question: what would the land itself want? And may we stay as humble and productive as the blessed earth itself. But more than just words like that, we need the actions to follow it, of course. And that's why we need the old greyhorns. I won't call Wes and I old farts, because we are trying to conceal how much methane we produce at this moment in our lives. But we have to remember that there are still farmers out there that are part of a 4,100-year unbroken tradition of growing food on this American continent. I've had the blessing of working with indigenous farmers of at least 24 tribes in the Southwest, and to see that there has been that oral transmission of knowledge that I could never get out of textbooks, still alive on this continent, is something that we don't want to lose. We need young greenhorns to not merely respect their elders and that traditions, but share it and build on the values embedded in all agrarian traditions, and at the same time, never to be afraid to innovate. On farms, innovation and tradition are good breeding stock to put together in the same pasture. It's time for this old gray horn to get out of the way. I've within the last 2 weeks, I've decided to give up writing. I've written 26 books over my life, and I figure I've reached my quota of words. And so I'm taking a word fast and spending time mentoring young people next weekend. I'm not going to be at a conference. I'm going to be cooking dinner for a benefit of about for about 40 people who are coming to support 8 kids, the Earth Care Youth Core group in our community that goes around high school kids thinking about college. None of their family members have ever gone to college, but to see how they respond to working with 8 different farmers and ranchers in our county who will mentor them for different work tasks so they get the whole gamut of potential livelihoods that they can do right where they live, whether they go to college or not. I'll offer help and encouragement when asked without trying to cling to my stale old notions, and I'll delight in anyone's innovations if they do something completely different than how I did, because the art and science of stewarding the land is built on iterative advances, not on ultimate fixed answers and absolute truths. So I want to do something participatory with all of you, and a couple of you have participated in this with me, and it's like those old funky things that Pete Seeger did before he died this last year, where I do a call out to you and you say the same words with your own name or your own career in it. So I want you to all stand up, and you're going to take your vows with me. So the first line, unfortunately, is the sloppiest. I'm going to say it and put in my name and what I am, and you put in yours, and it's just going to sound terrible, but it gets better after that. I, Gary Nabhan, an orchard keeper, eater, and gray horn. Wish to be among those here to renew our sacred vows. To care, love, and serve. The astonishing diversity of life on this earth. To nourish and support the many peoples of this planet. Through sickness and in health, I borrowed that line from someplace I can't remember. In times of crisis and times of joy. To offer continuity in land stewardship. To sow the seeds of food justice. To sow the seeds of food security. To sow the seeds of food democracy. To sow the seeds of true food sovereignty. Through our own actions. Of cultivating food and hope. And through our own eating patterns. So that we may all eat what we have truly sown. I reaffirm our covenant with this earth. To humbly be one more way. That seeds themselves, regenerate into more seeds to nourish all of us. Now go out to love and serve this earth. I love all of you. Thank you for your great work. Now we have just one more second before you all go out on your honeymoon and into that, you know, postmarital bliss. We're going to ask you to do a participatory exercise. This is not a pledge. This is a projection. It is to show the collective assets in this room that we may potentially be willing to share to help make this land transfer over the next generation something that contributes to what we all care about. And we're going to ask you to write down on a piece of paper one of three things or multiple things, but there's three categories, and do it as sort of a one, two, three. These will not be shared. These should all be anonymous. Change your handwriting if you want. But by the end of the meeting, we're going to tally this up and tell you what the results are. Woody Tash and I did this in Arizona, and it's empowered our community to start three new food and farming businesses just within the last 14 months. The first line is, what of your own personal slash family assets? And you can do this as donations that you might normally give some among your tithing or giving portfolio in your community or nationally to organizations that you would be willing to put either into young farmers themselves or into technical assistance for young farmers. So you can either put a number there of dollars or a sweat equity kind of pledge or something, but it's the personal part of it. You as a person and your family assets. Over the next 3 years, let's say that, because I'm not trying to, you know, say, Lord, if we don't reach $1 million, they're going to send me home, you know. I'm just saying we're going to do a number that you feel comfortable with that may be possible within 3 years' time. The second is if any of you are associated with institutions, foundations, family, charities, whatever, of what you think that you can give to support this through technical assistance, buying conservation easements, like we're doing at with our Borderlands restoration group in the Southwest, that part will be conservation easements, part will be real production to diversify our food system and create livable wages for people in our community. So it's what your institutions, whether you work for a food link or are associated with a foundation or even a communications group, what you think they can or will be putting into this over the next 3 years. And third is particularly for the young farmers in this room, and that's what you feel that you can put into this with your sweat equity and your creativity and your genius and your energy, which is so much at sometimes when I talk to Severin that it makes me want to guzzle down a whole bottle of Geritol. And the point is, there is stuff that people can do even if they don't have money, and particularly if we're trying to help young farmers, the first question we should not ask of them is, how much money can you put up? I want to know what you feel your strengths and assets are. So do a 1, 2, 3 so we can tally those numbers separately. And then how are we going to collect these, Severin?
With our hands.
With our hands. So just pass them down to the corner person in your section. Just have them feed that way. You can fold them in half that you want. And again, we'll tally these by the end of the day. And it's not about the numbers. It's about the collective assets in this room. Yes. The third one is largely for the young farmers to put down, and it's what they feel that they can contribute in response to whatever assets and goodwill the other people in this room are willing to put in. So if you're a Greyhorn like me, you can skip line three. And again,
don't skip it. We need your mentorship. We need your cultural courage.
Okay, I've been corrected. See, that's why we do this as community. So again, You can also put in sweat equity, just like Elizabeth said she's still doing with her efforts. And again, number one is personal and family assets, dollars or acres, for example. Okay? First one is personal and family. Second one is organizational. To a farmer, to a collective, to CSA, undecided at this time because we don't know all the possibilities. Anyway, thank you for your patience and all of that, and God bless you.